testing. Do you hear me?
One, two, three, no. Now, let's try it. This is an interview with Phyllis Sponic Carnahan for the Leelanau Voices Project of the Leelanau Historical Museum on November 14th, 1992. The interviewer is Mary Ellen Hajewski. Phyllis, thank you very much for being willing to give us a live demonstration. We're going to focus on your grandparents. Let's start with identifying material about them.
My paternal grandparents were Joseph and Elizabeth Sponic. They were both born in Prussia. Elizabeth was born in 1859. Joseph was born in 1850. Her parents were Mr. and Mrs. Stephen Nimchinsky.
Would you spell that name into the recording?
Her maiden name was Nimchinsky, N-I-E-M-C-Z-Y-N-S-K-I. They came to this, they were, let me get this back on. The Sponics and Nimchinskys were both serfs on a baronial estate in Prussia. And the Nimchinskys left in the, let me see, when did they leave? They left in the early 1860s to immigrate to the to the United States. They didn't disembark in New York City. Their boat went up the St. Lawrence River to Montreal, Canada. And they were supposed to take a train from Montreal to the United States. And as the train crossed the river, according to family folklore, the engineer was drunk and did not see that the bridge was open, and part of the train fell into the river. The Nimchinsky family at that time consisted of the mother and father, my grandmother Elizabeth, and Molly, and there may have been other ones, but I think some of the girls were born in the United States. In any case, Molly was a baby, and she was being carried in a wooden butter bowl, and when the train crashed, the bowl turned over on her and saved her from injury. But my grandmother, Elizabeth, was severely crushed on both feet. The family was separated, and it took 6 weeks before the Red Cross was able to reunite them. And when they finally were reunited, they moved on, I presume by train and probably by boat to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. In 1868, my great-grandfather, Stephen Nimchinsky, was in poor health, and he had heard that Michigan was a good place to live, and so he took the boat across to Glen Haven and then walked to Cleveland Township to an area near Sugarloaf and Lime Lake, and this was land that they could have if they homesteaded it, but it was all forest and everything. And he built a cabin that winter, and then he went back to Milwaukee to see if he could get some families to come to Michigan. And he persuaded some people to make the trip. And as I say, there were no roads and only blazed trails from Glen Haven to within 3 miles of what is now Isidore. But in any case, he brought his family over in 1868, and according to a report that a journal that my grandmother dictated to one of my uncles, it says the children weren't the only ones crying, and when at last they did arrive at the cabin he had built the winter before, the mother cried out, "Oh, why did you bring me into this hell?" His answer was, "Cheer up, Mother. Someday you'll see a nice church here." Well, anyway, the following year, more families came, and what's kind of amazing to me is, I don't know how big their house was. I don't think it was very large, but everybody seemed to stay with my great-grandparents until they could clear some land and build a house. And some of them didn't like it at all. It was very, very hard living. I mean, but they built cabins, and they had plenty of wild game for meat. And since there was no market for potatoes, they ate the potatoes, and so they didn't go hungry. There were no floors to get dirty either, only hard-packed ground, of which the straw used for bedding could easily be packed into a corner. The building of the cabins and clearing the land during the rest of the summer didn't leave them any time for raising any crops. So in the winter, all the men went to work around Leland, splitting cordwood. They made a living that way. And because there were no roads or anything, the men had to walk to Leland. And the women were left alone for weeks at a time. And it says, according to my grandmother, when the winter weather was bad, of course, there weren't many chores for them to do, but one can imagine the loneliness and fear. It was hard for the men as well. When they would leave Leland Saturday night, they would get home Sunday morning, leave home Sunday night, and get back into Leland in time to work Monday morning. They had to guess as to the direction because there were no roads and the snow was deep. And then 3 years after the Nimchimskis arrived, a stranger appeared, and this again in my grandmother's journal, and by the looks of him and the size of his beard, no one suspected he was Father Zorn, a missionary traveling from one place to another. After introducing himself, it didn't take long to notify the rest of the settlers. There were only 5 families all told. That night, everybody went to confession, and in the morning, after rigging up a table for an altar, he had mass and everybody received communion. He promised to come every 3 or 4 months, as it took him that long to make his rounds. There was no limit of joy at the prospect of having a priest that often. So then the following summer, more people came. Gersh, Filinski, Karzinski, Gatska, Popa, Joseph and Adam Sponik. Now here comes my grandfather.
And this is when?
And this was about in 1873. Okay. 3 Sponik men or boys came from Prussia. My grandfather Joseph, his brothers Adam and John. John Sponik went to Washington State to live, but Joseph and Adam came up here to Leelanau County. As she says, in that manner, the Polish settlement grew. There were many arguments and disputes with the French over homesteads, but that trouble was settled somehow. Father Zorn came for a number of years, and in 1876, the first Polish wedding took place. I'd like to back up a little bit, though. When my grandfather came in 1873, he came in September of 1873, and he didn't lose much time. He obtained his U.S. citizenship in December 1873 in Northport. Now this wedding that took place in 1876. It was the first Polish wedding, and the parties getting married were Joseph Sponik to Elizabeth Nimchimski by Father Zorn. And it was a great occasion. Everybody was invited. And for a number of years, the missionaries made the Nimchimski's cabin their headquarters. It was his wish, when the church was built, it would be on his place. That's my great-grandfather. That's where the first Catholic funeral was held in 1877. An infant son of Joseph Sponik was buried. And in 1880, 2 more Sponik children were buried there. But it says most of the settlers lived across the swamp through which the trail was almost impossible and to this day is not much better. And as majority rules, it was agreed that the cabin of Mr. Gatsky was the best located and where, until the old church was built in 1883, religious services were held in the old cabin just across the road from our present building. Now that's up in Isidore, and it's this house across the street from the Holy Rosary Church. Who the first person buried in our present cemetery at Holy Rosary, no one seems to know. And the marriage, first marriage, is a race between Jacob Fleece, who married my Aunt Molly, and some claim a man named John Hicklazinski. And Father Marak was the supervisor of the missionaries in northern Michigan, and he was one of the first to have Mass in the old church, and he worked among the Indians at Shelbytown. But anyway, my grandmother, of course, was extremely interested in this church and was a very devout Catholic all of her life, as all of my relatives were. I would like to, if I may, go back for a little family, one of these stories that you always have in your family. My grandfather and his brothers lived, as I say, on this, they were serfs on this baronial estate, and they were subject to conscription by the Prussian army. I don't know if there was a war on, but everybody had to go to the army, able-bodied young men. My grandfather wanted to go, but he was too short. They had very high standards. My Uncle Adam was tapped on the shoulder and said, "We're going to take you." So my Uncle Adam went out in the barnyard and he took a hatchet and he chopped off his trigger finger and part of his thumb so he wouldn't have to go. And it sounds rather bizarre, but I think that that was not too uncommon. And after all, they were had been conquered by the Germans, and they weren't too keen about going into into the army. But I have to tell you about my Uncle Adam. He lived in the country when I was a little girl with his daughter outside of Cedar, and he used to come in to see my grandmother. And he always wore, he was a beautiful little old man. He had white, beautiful white hair and a white Van Dyke beard, and he always wore this sort of rusty black suit and a black derby, and he carried a cane. And when he came into Cedar, if you're familiar with Cedar, the road comes in across the river, across the bridge, and we could see him coming, and the kids would all say, "Oh, there comes Uncle Adam, there comes Uncle Adam." So he would walk into town, and as soon as he got within speaking distance, the kids would say, "Show us your fingers, Uncle Adam, show us your fingers." And he would shake his fist at him and say, "Oh, you kids," you know. But anyway, that's one of the family stories. And my grandfather, Joseph Sponick, as I say, was a, I think my, both of my grandparents, my, I know that my grandmother went to the eighth grade, and I presume that my grandfather probably did, but he did that, he was educated in Europe, and my grandmother was educated in Milwaukee. But my grandmother spoke and wrote Polish, German, Bohemian, and English. I mean, she was not fluent, and she didn't spell correctly, but she could speak and understand and write all of those languages. And my grandfather, I have a journal of his. It's written in beautiful German, and then of course he could speak English and Polish as well, and I presume Bohemian too. And he wrote a letter to my father in 1911. I think it's rather interesting. He talks about one of his grandchildren, one of my cousins, who had been staying with them, said, "Mother was just getting ready to go to Traverse with little Sophie, and we were all very glad to hear from you, especially Mother. But we had quite a time at home on Saturday night, March 4th to Sunday. Little Sophie got so very sick with bronchitis that we thought she could not live till morning. She was almost choking, and it set me pretty near crazy. I did not know what to do. I wanted to phone Traverse that they should come out here with a doctor, but we were afraid to scare them so much. So about 5 o'clock in the morning, I saw Dr. Frelick stopping at Sullivan's house. We called him to see little, they had called him to see little Daniel. He was sick too, so I went out and called him in. And while I was talking with the doctor by Sullivan's house, there comes Mrs. Hockrattle. She wants him to come and see their little boy. He was sick too. So you see what a rumpus we had there. Well, the doctor gave us a prescription, and Mr. Hockrattle got George Mason out of bed and brought him to the drugstore to put up the medicines for us. Well, in a day or two, little Sophie got better, but as Sophie commenced to get better, Mama came down with the grip. She was laid low for 2 days after she got a little better. Then we both went off to Traverse, and Mama stayed there till Friday evening and so forth. And but anyway, you can imagine the...
Will you date that?
That was 1911. Yeah. The actual March 14th, 1911, this letter was written. And this gives a little background about his involvement with Cedar. He says...
his responsibility.
Yeah. He said that... Mr. Culver has got quite a few logs in the yard, and Frank says, that's my Uncle Frank, my dad's brother, says he's got his lumber all sold already. If that's the case, then he may come out all right. I was afraid that he would get in the hole. Well, old Jerry and his wife, that's the Sullivans, the lumber barons who really founded Cedar, are still traveling in California, and young Jerry is getting his automobile in readiness. Then it goes on, Charlie Hockrattle lost his case with Mrs. Antwine. He had to pay $600 in costs. The whole rumpus cost him over $1,200. Well, I think we're going to have a pickle salting station in Cedar. And I have been around with the agent amongst the farmers to get the acreage. We were out 3 days and got over 100 acres subscribed, but had to stop on account of the bad roads. The agent is from Manistee and is a Polish fellow. He will come back again as soon as the roads will be better. They want about 150 to 200 subscribers if they can, and I think he will get it, and so forth. But I mean, I think he was in some official capacity because he was going around to try to get these farmers to subscribe to the pickle station, which we used to call it the pickle factory. And when I was little, it was still down by the railroad tracks. It's gone now. And then my grandfather in 1921, in the opening of bass season, in June, he went out in a canoe at 4 o'clock Thursday morning. And when he did not return at noon, they sent a search party out to look for him. And at 7 o'clock, his body was found floating beneath his overturned canoe near shore. No details of the tragedy are available, as no one saw it occur. Mr. Sponick was one of the prominent residents of Leelanau County. For several years, he was a supervisor representing his township, and he also held other responsible offices in the county. Parenthetically, I read in the Leelanau Enterprise that 100 years ago, I think it was in 1991, he was secretary of the Democratic Party of Leelanau County. He was well known in Traverse City, and so it goes on to tell about him, and it's another family story that when they found him, this lake, it's called Little Lake, it's immediately adjacent to the southern part of Lake Leelanau, where the Cedar River, or the Victoria Creek, runs up into the river. It's very shallow, and anyway, they found his body, and the turtles had started to eat him, which is, of course, a story that was, and my mother was forever absolutely paranoid about us being out in boats and swimming. We did all that, but anyway, it was, you know, it made it rather. It was just one of those rather awful stories. But anyway. They had moved to Cedar in 1907 in the house in which I live now. So they lived there, and my mother met my father during the flu epidemic. She was his nurse. He was very, very ill with pneumonia. And then she married him in 1919, and they lived with my grandfather and grandmother in the house on Sullivan Street. And then in 1920, they moved, my grandfather and grandmother moved two houses down where they lived until where my grandfather died in 1921, and my grandmother died in 1933. My Uncle Frank lived in that house, and they all lived there together. And my grandmother died in March of 1933. She was a long time and highly respected resident of Cedar, according to the paper. And she was 74 years old. And as I say, everybody in town called her Busha, which is Polish for grandmother. And I never knew my grandfather because he died. I was 3 months old when he died, or drowned, but I did know my grandmother, an absolutely wonderful woman. Any other questions?
Well, I think this is ordinarily, let me ask you the sources for your information,
okay,
because you're extremely well prepared, and this is a very coherent history, really much more coherent than we would expect from most interviews. So your sources are?
Well, this one, the major source of the early, of them coming to Leelanau County is this report that my grandmother dictated to my Uncle Steve. I call it the history of Leelanau County, but it's really not that. It's really the history of the parish of Holy Rosary. And then I have a letter that my grandfather wrote to my father in 1911, and I have newspaper clippings about their deaths, and the rest is, you know, it's just family talk and history. So I think that covers it.
Some very nice pictures, which we will try to describe. This is another thing that we do,
okay,
in an interview. With pictures, we attempt to describe them verbally for the record.
All right, the pictures that I will include in this oral history are first a picture of Mr. and Mrs. Stephen Nimchimpsky, who are parents of Elizabeth Sponick, my grandmother, and then a picture of my grandparents, Joseph Sponick Sr. and Elizabeth. And then I have a picture of the homestead on April Road in Cleveland Township where my grandfather and grandmother lived. It's a log cabin. It has disappeared, with an earth floor. And in this house, 8 children were born. 5 survived, starting with my father, Joseph, then, and Frank, and Mary, and Anna, and Stephen. And this picture that I have shows the log cabin. It shows my grandmother sitting on a chair, holding a baby, who is my Uncle Frank. My father is standing beside her. And then on her right and on her left are my Aunt Mary and my Aunt Anna. And then my grandfather is standing with his pair of mules. And there's a pig in the picture and a goose. And then the next two pictures are pictures of the house on Sullivan Street where I still live. The first picture shows my Uncle Steve standing in the yard, my grandmother, Elizabeth, my grandfather holding my cousin Louise Panic, who was his granddaughter, and then a man identified as Dr. Branch. And then another picture of the same house, I think this was probably a little later, as I say, they moved there in 1907, and there's a man sitting on top of a ladder, presumably painting the house, I don't know who he is, and the woman standing on the sidewalk is my grandmother, my Busha, Elizabeth Sponick.
Yabusha.
Yeah.
And what does that mean? Yabusha.
Means grandmother.
Means grandmother.
And my grandfather was my jaja.
My jaja?
Mm-hmm.
Can you spell those?
Busha is B-U-S-I-A. Jaja, I haven't an idea of how to spell it.
Well, thank you very much, Phyllis. You understand that in order for the Leelanau Voices Project to use the information on this tape, your permission is needed. You've agreed to allow us to use this information. You've signed such an agreement, or you will have.
Yes, I understand that.
Thank you very much, Phyllis. It's a lovely interview.
It was my pleasure.